Welcome to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper, and I'm only as hip as my guest. And I got to tell you something, people. You know, I have not recorded an episode in almost a month, and I have not done that in over 12 years. And it's just I've been working on a few other projects. I have Coop's Comedy Corner, my new YouTube show where I'm interviewing a lot of stand-up comics I know, TV writers. Then I have The Coop Tank, which is a business show, which I interview a lot of South Jersey and Philadelphia business people. It's a little roundtable. But we're back, and I have some great guests coming up. And today is no different. You know him. You love him. It's Uncle Cracker. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good, man. How are you?
Good, good, good. You know, I know you've been asked this 1,000 times, but how do you go from Matthew Schaefer to Uncle Cracker?
Like, in an instant. It's like, okay. it always feels like it's hovering, and then you don't really have to be Uncle Cracker until you step on stage, I guess. Until you have to
put on... No, but so where did the nickname come from? Because people call me Coop because my last name's Cooper. It makes sense. But for yours, where did it all come from? And it's stuck, which is great because it's one of those things where you hear an artist and you want to hear who that is. You go, oh, I want to check that person out.
But just growing up in Detroit, that was the nickname the kids gave me. And I felt like I was the only person that didn't know what it meant. And it just kind of stuck as I got older. You know, people nicknamed me Cracker, and it was Cracker this and Cracker that, and it was... when it came time to do an album, when I got a record deal with Atlantic Records eons ago, there was already a band called Cracker. So we had to put something either before Cracker or after Cracker to make it, just to make it legitimate, to make it legal, I guess, not legitimate. Well, so Uncle Cracker stuck.
Well, you know, and as I said, it's rememberable. Now, I want to talk about your early days, but I want to talk about your album, Coffee and Beer, and why it took you 12 years to come out with an album, because I know, you know, you had very great success on your first album. I mean, it shot up the charts. And I know artists, I've talked to a lot of musicians, there's always that record companies are a pain in the ass and that. But why did it take you 12 years? What was it just writer's block? Was it just something you just were like, you know what? I just want to perform my old stuff. What happened?
Well, you know what? So I'm, like you said, I was just kind of humming along. And then I think probably about 2000, there was no writer's block, number one. No writer's block. There just wasn't any urgency to make a record or to release one, I guess, at that point. I think I was just coasting along. And then all of a sudden, bam, you get smacked with a divorce. Things happen. You know, you got kids. You're raising kids. Life just kind of happened in there. There was a 12-year span where... I had some obligations at home I had to fulfill, and that was it, man. I don't even have an answer. Like 12 years, when you say it and I think about it, I'm like, holy shit, 12 years, that's a long time. And what was I doing, right? But here's the thing, in between there was some bits and pieces. I had gotten off of Atlantic Records in about 2012, and then in 12, I had bought my record from Atlantic and released it on Sugar Hill. And that was my Midnight Special album. A couple years after that, the guy that signed me at Lava Records at Atlantic, Jason Flom, signed me again to this like weird little single deal. And it had been years since I had been with him. So then I couldn't maneuver for a couple years after that either. So there was a couple year gap, then a couple year gap after I signed that weird single deal. And that thing, I put out some single there in like 15 or 16, maybe 15-ish or 16. It never did anything. Nobody was home on that one. And then I guess it's a few more years, I put out Floating, a single. So a full album, yes, 12 years, but it wasn't like I was being lazy or not doing anything. I'm always writing, and I had been touring, but God, I wish I had a better answer for why there was a 12-year gap in there, but it was definitely a lot of life.
Now, when you go back in, and you said you were recording stuff in between, but when you finally do that album after 12 years, are you worried? I mean, I know you said, you know, it was a writer's block, and... You know, I have a background in stand-up comedy. The stuff I did back in the day is not what I do now. You know, I took a lot of time off because I just, I'm more myself. I've grown, you know. I'm not the, hey, you know, tell one joke and go on. I want to explain. For you, were you ever worried that, you know, you have great fans, but were you worried that when you're writing, if it was going to be right for them? Because once again, you've changed the genre a little bit since your beginning. I mean, his latest album is mostly country, but in early parts you were hip hop, rock, everything. So when you sat there and wrote it, were you worried about your target audience, or did you just say, fuck it, I'm going to do what I got to do and hopefully they'll like it?
I've always done what I wanted to do. It was always maybe a little hodgepodge of things. Just from being a DJ, I always like to mess around and try to add records. And, you know, always, you know, long time ago, looking for samples and things like that. My process is still the same when it comes to writing songs. I like to listen to old music. I like to listen to some of my favorites, some of my not so favorites. I like to reference things a lot before I go in to write. I like to do that. But I know there was nothing. It was time for an album, and it was like, this is the album. Like, I don't have any other process, and I've never really worried about where it was going to land, where these songs were going to end up. I mean, they're always grateful for my fans, and I just always thought, and maybe this is naive to think that if they were into me, they'd be into it. Maybe some people get used to one thing, but what if I'm not into that thing anymore? Then I guess we part ways, right? It's like a little breakup.
That's a good point to have, because that's the true artist. You know, the true artist sits there and goes, you know what? I'm going to do what I want to do. And if people don't like it, you can't please everybody. And a lot of times, if you please everyone, people are like, oh, this person's a sellout. Or you know how it goes through, like, you know, oh, they did this. But it's good that you do that. And so you mentioned earlier your influences. Who are some of your musical influences? Like, when you were younger, you know, I mean, I'm a classic rock and 80s new wave guy. I mean, that's what I grew up on. What were your influences when you were younger?
When my earliest influences were all the Motown records, all the old Motown stuff. And then, like, the early, like, the AM 70 stuff, like the James Taylor, BJ Thomas, that type of stuff. Those were, my goodness, even down to, like, Neil Diamond and Barry Manilow, things like that. Like, my dad listened. He was so Motown. He had three favorite country artists. They were Conway Twitty, Patsy Cline, and George Jones. He listened to either those three records or he listened to all Motown. Well, that was late night. But then my mom, like, during the day, she was all AM 70. So there was this, and then as I got older, I started listening to rap music, EPMD, Run DMC, those types of things. But my early influences were Motown and AM 70 stuff. Absolutely. Those are my early on influences for sure. A lot of music in my house growing up, always.
See, that's so important, you know, and it's also that, you know, because you get that different angles and you're not stuck with, you know, if you have one, like if your dad always listened to Led Zeppelin, you'd probably be like staying to that all the time and you miss out, even though it's great music and I love Zeppelin, but it's something that it's good that your parents listen to different things and that put that spark in you. So the spark in you. So what made you get into music? What's your path? Because, like, for me, you know, I loved comedy when I was younger, and then I sat there and went to college, and I made some people laugh in this one contest, and it stuck to me. But I always had that urge for comedy. What was your spark to start your career? What made you follow this, your passion?
What sparked me was probably 1984-ish. 1983, 84, I was probably around. So long ago. The Fat Boys. So the Fat Boys came out with Not All You Can Eat. It was a jail.
I'm in jail because I'm fat.
That's right. And I remember seeing that like on a Friday or Saturday night on like the public cable show. And, you know, you could only see that rap stuff in the mid 80s after 10:30 p.m., right? So I saw this video, and this whole rap thing was new to me. And I was like, I can do that. And I just remember I immediately started writing my own raps. And And it wasn't too long. I got my first drum machine and started programming my drum machine and started doing my own thing. And I got my first record deal when I was 15.
Wait, who gave you a record deal at 15?
Paragon Records. They were like a house label out of Detroit. You know, they put out, remember that song, Big Fun? We're having big fun.
Yeah, yeah.
They put Big Fun, years, going years, right? And I forgot where I was at on that. I was going somewhere with it.
You were 15 and you got a deal with Paragon.
Yes, 15, got a deal. That fizzled out, and then I started DJing for Kid Rock.
Now, how did you meet him?
I met him at a bar in Metro Detroit area that turned into a teen club on Sunday nights. And there was a local DJ on the R&B station named the Electrifying Mojo. And he hosted this DJ battle competition at this teen club on this Sunday night. I was 13 years old. And we went to this club to watch this. Or my brother was DJing at the time, too. So he wanted to go to this battle competition. I, of course, went along with him and his buddy. We get there. Kid Rock's there. Yet Kid Rock didn't bring his own turntables, paid my brother $100 to use his turntables, and then smoked him on his own turntables. And then it was just, I was 13 when I met him at a dance club.
Now, when do you start working? Not at 13, you're not working for him. I mean, when do you start this relationship with Kid Rock? The actual working relationship.
So probably about 6 months, 7 months after that, I was driving out to his folks' house where he lived, and we would go in the barn, and we would make rap songs, rap records. I'd say records, but we weren't pressing any vinyl. But we were making music in his parents' barn when I was probably almost 14. I'd have to pay somebody, drive me out there, come me back. You know, it was 25 minutes away, and that was a little out in the country. But so that early on, we were making, we were kids.
So now, when do you start gigging with them? Like, when do you start gigging and then deciding that you can go out on your own? I mean, because that's a big thing. When you're 13 or 14, one thing is you have no fear. You know, I used to work with a comic in Philly. The kid was 14. He would say anything. He would kill. He was a kid from the inner city. He would get on the stage in Philadelphia. No fear. Like, as us were older, we're like, well, if we screw up a joke, we're not going to get paid. We're not going to do this. He didn't care. So when did you actually start making money? Because, you know, 13 and 14, I mean, most of us have paper routes.
I might have had a paper route then, too. Shoot, I still don't think I've made any money, to be honest. It's been that long. I was 16 when I started DJing for Kid Rock, and there wasn't a lot of Kid Rock shows. He would do this thing where he would kind of do a Midwestern loop. You know, we'd dip into Cleveland, we'd dip down into Dayton, Ohio. We'd go to Cleveland, we'd go down to Columbus, Ohio, we'd hit Cincinnati, then we'd go over through Kentucky, back up through Illinois, and just make this Midwestern loop, probably once every year and a half or something. But we'd hit these clubs, and Kid Rock, he was always smart about it. We would hit these clubs every year and a half, and he would make it seem like we'd been on, like, global tour, right? Like, this is it. You're going to see this tonight, and he'd give 110% in every one of them shitholes. It was no money. It was bar tab and Denny's, you know, afterward pretty much. And it was like that for years. It was like that until probably 21, 22 I was when Kid Rock got his deal at Atlantic. I was still DJing for him. And we went on tour, and probably about 6 months into touring, probably about 9 months into the first Kid Rock record, the record label Atlantic gave me a solo record deal because everything I'd written off the Kid Rock stuff. They gave me a record deal then, and then I started seeing a couple bucks. But
Well, how nerve when you get this solo deal? I mean, you're writing, but how, as an artist, you know, you're looking at, you have a solo deal. You have to bring something to the table. So did you have a game plan of, you know, how you're going to write this song or how you're going to get these musicians? I mean, how does someone attack? Because you were basically a DJ who was also writing. So when you sit there, first of all, it must be a great feeling. You're like, oh, I got a record deal. But then you must go, holy shit, I got a record deal. I mean, what was your process to making that first album?
So just not to back it up at all, but while we were on tour, we had bought this little digital, Akai came out with this like, digital 8-track thing. And, we had bought this thing while we were on a Warp tour, and, we were in an RV, and I remember we were on tour and we were trying to figure this thing out so we could continue to keep making new stuff while we were on this thing. Well, Kid Rock was like, well, why don't we do something here? Grab that and, write something for that, because he wanted me to be the guinea pig on this new equipment, right? So I had made this song called Better Days. I wrote this song called Better Days. We recorded it right there on the RV. And it was very, very reminiscent of, and at the around the same time as Everlast had a song out called Then You Might Not Sing the Blues or something like that, right? But I remember Atlantic hearing that song, and they thought I was going to be this answer to Everlast, right? So they gave me this record deal. I do remember sitting back going, now what the fuck am I going to do? Like, I got this record deal. I know I'm capable, but I don't have a plan. Never did. I was comfortable DJing for Kid Rock, and but that's how that swung out.
So you get the record done, and what's your feeling about it? Because, you know, I think artists have two different things. One, there's the people who are just like, this is the greatest thing ever. Then the other who, like, they constantly worry. When you finally got it done, what was your feeling? I mean, were you just like, this is really good? Or were you like, I could have done better? And then now, and the second part of that, looking back at it now, what do you think?
I do remember finishing that record and being, I was like, thank God, that's done, right? And it wasn't even me to say it was done. It was Kid Rock, because he was producing it. Mike Bradford co-produced it. And together they were kind of like, well, this is it. This is a wrap. And I'm like, all right. I've never really completed a project like this before. But then I just remember sitting back like, it's kind of easy. And then I was like, wait a minute. That was too easy. Then I start second-guessing everything. But it's too late. We already FedExed everything out to New York. And it was just... it was done, because we recorded that record on a Pro Tools rig on tour in the back of a bus. And I just remember a lot of emotion, because I was in the back. I didn't plan on a record deal, nor was I looking for one. It was just like, bam, there it is. And it was a big gift is what it was. And looking back, I wish I would have had a better plan, but if I would have had something planned, I would have fucked it up anyway. So it was very organic. I can say that now. And I look back and I listen to it every now and then. A buddy of mine will pop it in, thinks he's being funny or whatever, like I'm going to be embarrassed by it or something. But, and there are some things I say 25 years ago where I am a little tongue-in-cheek.
But, like what? What is, give me an example. Because it's you know, once again... You're 50 now? 49? So
50.
You're 25. I mean, like, as I said, when I did stand up when I was 23, it's completely the shit I was saying. It was also the late 80s, early 90s. So it was a completely different culture. Okay. It was completely. So, like, yeah. What is something that you look back and go, holy crap, I can't believe I said that? And would you change it if you could now?
I'd never change it because I'm happy with it. But I do look back and I'm like, you know, something. But it was also, everything was very, everything was very on par with what we were doing as kids. You know, when we were younger, me and Kid Rock hanging out when we were younger, we did a lot of dumb stuff. And we definitely weren't afraid to write about it and sing about it. It's just the only thing we knew, instead of like We didn't even know it was a thing to lie about stuff, you know, or be to be dishonest. You know, you could beef a couple of things up and tell somebody you had a couple more bucks than you really did for rap purposes. You know what I mean? But it was but that was just a little fluff. But when it comes, so when I look back at like something I might have said on like a on like one of them rap songs where I might have been talking about fighting or, you know, I mean, even now I look back, you know, just saying the word pussy. You know, it's like a, it's not something, I say, I just said it now and it felt weird to say it. Like, you just don't, I don't say that word, but I was calling somebody else a pussy on the record. I wasn't referring to any, but now being 50, I've raised three daughters. And, you know, as that went on, you know, it's just, I didn't have kids then when I did make the record. When you write things, you know, I wasn't anticipating life after that, right? Just it is fun to look back and see. It's crazy how times have changed and continue to change so much so fast.
Now, do you remember the first time you actually heard something off your solo album on the radio? Because there's so many stories, like, you know, I talk to musicians, some of the metal guys from the 80s, like they're driving down Sunset Boulevard and they hear it and they're like, oh my God. Or one of the guys from Skid Row heard it on the boardwalk in New Jersey. They're playing it at, like, you know, because in New Jersey there's a boardwalk where there's, they used to give albums out and they play all this different shit. But do you remember the first time you heard it, a song by you?
Yes, the first time I heard it, like on a radio, I was out on tour and I flew home and I landed in Detroit. And on the way home, my house was probably about an hour from the airport or so. And I remember driving and all of a sudden it came on the radio station and I was like, well, I was on the phone with David Allan Coe at the time and I was like, hold on, David. And I started listening. I said, hold on, David, my song's on the radio. Hold on. And I was, put it down. Then it was over, and I, like, turned the radio down, and I was like, sorry about that, man. I was like, I just heard my song on the radio for the first time. And he's like, well, what'd you think? And I'm like, sounded good. You know, it sounded good on the radio. And it was just and I meant good, like, not like that song's sweet, but I meant like we mixed it the right way. Like, it didn't sound weird. You know, everything was good.
And it's such an accomplishment. And that's the one thing, you know, it's like so many things that no one ever gets to do. Like, no one sits there, you know, I mean, I interview a lot of musicians, but I know of a lot of other musicians who have never heard their song on the radio, unless it's like a local, you know, Philadelphia local artist thing. So it must be a great feeling. So what was it like for you when you know, your song, I mean, it started shooting, I mean, Follow Me started shooting up to, like, I think it peaked at number 5. So what is that like as an artist? Is it because everyone, you can never say, people never expect a song to do great. It just takes off. What was it like for you as an artist, and why do you think it hit a certain chord? Because, I mean, it's a good song to listen to. And then that's the thing. But what do you think made it special? And what is it like for an artist when you sit there and go, holy crap, I'm in the top 10 of Billboard?
It was crazy because it was at the time, you know, Billboard was a you know, you could kind of trust Billboard at the time. You could also count on, like, you know the Nielsen sound scans, and everything was all it wasn't about the money, it was about the money. So all the numbers, everybody was all zoned in on what was going to happen come every Tuesday. It was just I remember it being, there was so much going on because I was still on tour with Kid Rock DJing while Follow Me was selling 120,000 albums a week. And it was nuts. Everything around me was nuts. I remember we couldn't get past 5 or whatever it was at radio because there was so many burned bridges. You know, Kid Rock was always like, fuck the radio. So when we needed, you know, mathematically, you need LA's spins, you know, at Kiss FM in order to even make number one. So they're not going to add it at number one because they don't like Kid Rock, right? And so now I'm part of that whole clique. So there was just a lot of inner turmoil too, like, oh, man, how are we going to do this? And then not only there, but like it was like number one in like every country except here. It was just, there was so much going on. It was too much to pay attention to. It was nutty.
Does that feed your ego at all, though? I mean, we can say, oh, we're not. I mean, seriously, I mean, I don't care what people say. What's that?
I could see how it could feed somebody's ego. Never mind, though. Never mind. I'm always the, I'm always like worst case scenario guy, and I'm like, I don't know. Are you sure? I don't know. We should do that. Like, no, don't drop my name. You know, just everything's. I was way more comfortable DJing for Kid Rock in the way back.
But no. Why do you think people really took to the song? You know, what is it like? As when you wrote it, I'm sure, you know, when you wrote it, it may have had a certain feeling. And sometimes people write songs and they don't have a certain feeling. They just, it sounds good. But why do you think people took to that song, and especially worldwide? Because, you know, a lot of times artists don't hit number one in a bunch of other countries.
I think at the time it was different than other things that were playing on the radio at the same exact time. And I think that was number one because it stood apart. It stood out immediately from what was happening at the exact time. Just because it was like this acoustic-y thing with a little, you know, with a little rap beat underneath it. The label put out remix of it. They put out all kinds of different shit. But I think the familiarity of it, probably, it was just a warm. I don't know. It was very. It was just very easy, I think. You know, I think it went down easy. I don't know what made people gravitate towards it. Maybe there's a little cheating theme. Maybe some people liked it. Then there's a ton of people that don't get they don't listen at all, and they don't get the theme. I get people that come up, they use that for their wedding song, and I'm like, it's weird. You use the cheating song for your wedding. But then you get the people that do get it, and they're like, I met my wife with that one. Yep, she's married. Met her, heard that song, thought it was us. Like, okay, you know, go ahead, get in there. But, and it was, you know, it was all that. That song started in one place and ended up in another by the time it was finished. And it was fun to see it work. I had a single out before it that didn't work. So when that one worked, it was fun to watch.
Now, when that works, does the record company start getting on you to say, hey, man, stop touring with Kid Rock. You got to go out and do solo because that's, you know, that's how they're going to make money. But what was it like? Because, you know, did they sit there and want you to go solo? And did you, like, go out on a tour?
Well, the plan was for me to just continue when Bob, Kid Rock, and the band all went home. I was staying out on my own for the next year and a half. Which is hard to watch after you've been out for, you know, 3 years with all your buddies and they all go home and you're still out like grinding. That was tough, but no, there was no pressure for them for that. Mainly because, they didn't do anything to, ruffle Kid Rock's feathers. They would never, you know, everybody's always tiptoeing around him anyhow, you know, at that time, Double Out of Cause, it was probably at about 12 million sold, you know, so he couldn't do anything wrong and nobody could tell him anything, especially somebody in a suit, right?
Right. So
that wasn't work.
So when do you start work on the second album? And is it a matter of, do they want a song like Follow Me? Are they in your ear going, you know what, we need to follow up. And now we'll talk about the follow up, the single that hit big there too. But what was their choice? Did they sit there and go, we need this album quickly? Because once again, you're a guy who said you would have been fine in the background. So all of a sudden a record company is going, hey, yeah, here, come out with another. Because back then albums came out every year. It wasn't like now, you know, and you waited 12 years, but as you said, you could coast. But, and a lot of bands did it. But back then, as soon as you had a hit, they wanted you to work on a new album.
So, well, this was, you're going to like this. So there was this, at the tail end of like my final, like touring stuff from that first album, they wanted me to end up, they wanted me to do like a month and a half in Europe, you know, to end my promo run. And they knew I didn't want to go to Europe. I had no desire to go to Europe at all. I was young. I didn't want to be anywhere. I didn't even like spending the night at other people's houses when I was a kid. So going to Europe for this, I was tired. I was done. So anyway, I get to Europe, and I get there. It's the first night. And somebody said something that made me mad. It set me off. So I went back to the hotel. It was a label person. And I went back to the hotel that night, and I didn't call the tour manager. I called the bus driver, and then I called everybody else. And I said, meet me out front. We're going to the airport. We're all going back home. So I leave the tour manager because I knew I would catch shit. He was going to call the powers that be. He was going to call everybody else. So anyway, they drop us off at the airport, and I remember we were in Frankfurt. We're in Germany. I remember, like, with my American Express, and I'm like, I need 9 flights to Detroit, please, you know. So this was a big debacle for me. The record label wouldn't talk to me after this. They were infuriated. I fly home, and I kind of didn't want to. It was nutty. I come home. I came home, and then I was kind of like ashamed, almost like I should have stayed. But then I don't know, to ease my mind, I called Mike Bradford, who had co-produced the first album, and I was like, come up to Detroit. And I set up a studio above my attorney's office downtown. And we just sat there, and we banged out about 20 new songs immediately, but without anybody asking. But then, like, everybody cooled off, you know, for a couple months, I guess, and then they were like, all right, it's time for a new record, but I already had it. So I just it was a weird time.
So how did Drift Away come about? Because as you said, you liked the 70s AM, and I still remember driving in my parents' car and hearing it. That's like everyone knows that song. How did that come about? And then how did you get Dobie Gray involved? Because that makes it that much cooler.
Well, so Drift Away happened when I was doing my first records promo runs, where you go to the radio stations at 6 a.m. They want you to play 3 acoustic songs. Follow Me was the only one anybody knew, and I didn't have anything on that album that sounded like Follow Me, because it was mostly rap stuff. Follow Me was just kind of like standing on its own there. Well, I started singing Drift Away at these promo things in the mornings. Well, I went to, what is it, Z100 in New York in the morning. Scott Shannon, legendary DJ. I think he ran the whole station too, maybe, or something, but legendary disc jockey, Scott Shannon, he calls the record label, and he's like, you guys are fucking up if you don't have Cragger do that Drift Away. You know, he did that in the promo thing, and so, of course, Scott Shannon says this. You know, he was the program director at the time, too, so they're like, you got to cut Drift Away. You know, and I was like, okay, but it's not going to be the lead single off the second record. I'm not going to do a cover for my second, to follow up my first record. So they're like, okay. And then they put out In a Little While, and everybody just kind of hummed and hawed about it. And then Drift Away, and it worked, thank goodness. But it was, if it wasn't for Scott Shannon, that song wouldn't have covered it.
Well, how did Dobie Gray get involved in it? Did you contact him, or did someone contact him? Did Scott Shannon contact him? What happened?
The record label contacted Dobie Gray, and it was weird at first because they asked me what I thought about having him guest on it, and I was like, "Well, I guess that'd be cool, you know." And it was cool. He was very cool. It was very nice to meet him and get to know. He was very gracious. He did everything we asked without putting up a stink or nothing. I remember he was really cool about it. He wanted us to make a donation to a charity that he liked. I can't remember offhand which charity it was, but we did it, and he did whatever, man. He'd fly to LA to do Leno. He would do Letterman. He would do whatever. He was very, and you don't get that a lot of times, you know. And I think it was because he was older. Maybe he had a little more time on his hands than a younger artist that had something going on at the radio, maybe. But he was very, very, whatever we needed, whatever we wanted. Come to Detroit for the video. And like I said, he was older at the time. So very, very, very cool of him to muscle through that, I guess.
Now, did any until now, Do you like shooting videos? Because a lot of people don't understand. I've been on Hollywood sets before. And it's not like, hey, walk in. Hey, I'm here. It's like, yeah, sit in the goddamn trailer. Or, you know, this is going to take this camera, this camera. What has your experience been with shooting videos? Is it something you enjoy? Or is it something you're like, if I don't need to do it, I'd rather not?
That is my take on it. Like, if I don't have to do it, I'd look perfect. Let's not do it at all, you know. I'm not a fan of videos. And not for any other reason. Like, I'm definitely not I'm not like a purist, you know, or nothing like that. And I'm about to say this, and it might sound weird, but I almost think a video's ruin a song for people. You know, I think a certain visual can fuck up somebody's completely, you know. I'd rather them listen to a song and interpret what they're going to interpret, as opposed to see, you know, some goofy kid sitting in a truck, you know, driving around in the fucking swamps, whatever we're doing, whatever it is, right? I just think that can side, I think that can side rail that song, you know. I think it can taint it, is what I'm saying. And again, I'm not one of them cats where I just feel that way. But, and I've spent 50 years hiding because I'm fat. So I'm like, I'm not doing a fucking video. Why do we need to do that? Video, right?
So
I'll be over here eating.
Give me eating in the video, which it's actually hard to eat on a camera. You're supposed to be peas and carrots when you're in a restaurant in a scene. So what was your mental state when the second album didn't sell as good as the first? Do you ever worry about that as the artist? Because I always say artists are, I think a lot of us, we're half insecure and we're half narcissistic, where we want to be seen and heard, but when it happens, we go, oh shit, man, you know, why are they interested in us? But what happens, because your first album was such a hit, and the second album did good, but it didn't match the first. What does that be like as an artist? What did you go through?
Well, I went through this on the first single. It tanked fast. Well, the very first single was Yeah, 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 and it tanked. So then we waited 6 or 7 months. You know, them cycles they use were lengthy. So I think we waited 6 months before we did the next single, which was Follow Me. That worked. Well, then after Follow Me, we came back with Yeah, Yeah, Yeah again, and it tanked. So then I was like, all right, cool. It's time to do the record, new record. We'll do the new record. In a little while, comes out. It's just kind of like, meh. But then Drift Away. Drift Away did huge, but it didn't do huge, you know, physical sales numbers-wise, right? But radio-wise, it was fine. Things like that, you know, the action was good. As an artist, though, after that first one tanked on that first album, my whole mindset was just like, there's not, what can I do? You know, it's just, it is what it is, you know, so when the second album, the success of that one was just, you know, not even near the first one, it didn't faze me. I had already been through, like, you know, tanked singles and whatnot. My brain was like, all right, well, let's do a new one. Let's do it, you know. because I was signed to Kid Rock, to Atlantic. So, and Kid Rock still held the, he still held the three-pack bonanza at the time, right? So I was like, all right, well, I'm just going to do a new record. They're not going to let me go yet. Well, they had too much money in me anyway to let me go. They weren't going to let me off that fast. So I wasn't that worried or upset. I've never been that worried or upset, though. None of this has ever made me feel like I never let them get to me. But I can see how people do. I have friends that are just insane about this stuff.
Now you've done a lot of TV shows early on. What was your favorite TV show? What was it like doing? You said you did Letterman. What was it like doing Letterman? Because I heard if Letterman likes you, he'll talk to you. But if he doesn't, he doesn't want anything to do with you. But he's a big music lover. I mean, he helped break the Hootie and the Blowfish because he kept playing them. He always made jokes because he loved the name. But what was your experience with Letterman and with Leno?
Letterman... I definitely did Letterman less than I did Leno. Letterman, I only did Good Lord, I'm wondering if I even did Letterman solo, to be honest. I know I did it, DJing for Kid Rock. I just remember Letterman's place being, it was freezing cold in his place. And you weren't supposed to, interact with him. If you seen him in the hall, you're supposed to let it go. You're just like, hey man, can I get a picture? Who knows what he's probably, I don't know. But I was also a huge Letterman fan. God, I don't know if I did him myself solo. But Leno, yes. I remember I'd done to Leno so many times. He came in my dressing room and I was like, four times? You gave me the same fucking t-shirt you gave me the last four times I did the show. So the next time I came through, they gave me the watch, the Leno watch. Leno was always great, though. He'd always come in and say hello, and he was very, very LA, just the.
I used to run into him when I lived in LA. There was an Italian deli, and it was called Monte Carlo. And he just you go, hey, and he remembered everything because he used to play at a comedy club in Philadelphia called the Comedy Works. And I said, I remember you. And he's like, oh yeah, Jimmy Tyune's place. Yeah, and he remembered that from like 19. I mean, he was probably there way. And that's the thing. I think he just loved. He loved the industry. He just loved it.
When you talked to him, didn't it feel like he was like, I remember always talking to him and I just remember always looking at him thinking like he doesn't give one fuck. Like I just felt like he was great though. Like he was answering, but there was a thing about him. It was just very like, I can't put my thumb on it. But there was just something about him that he was always awesome, stop and talk, the nicest human, like in quick. And then I just always remember, thinking that about him.
So, at what point in your career, you've had a lot of success, and that's a thing, and that's great. But what point in your career? Well, first of all, what made you move to Nashville? And was it Kenny Chesney or I mean, what happened? What made you really start going the more of the country route? Because as I said, your last album. I mean, for me, I think country music to me now, like the newer country, reminds me of Southern rock, and to me, that's what it is. It's not like. If you're older, you have an idea of what country used to be, and those guys are like so like, oh yeah, I don't hear anything else, But if you're my age, you're like, hey, yeah, this is good stuff. But what was your factor to start really going country? Because that's what you, I mean, if you classified you now, you are a country artist. So I mean, what was it? Was there an influence? Was there? I mean, what was the turn? Where did it come from?
Well, back in high school, I was listening to rap records. And then I got a hold of a Hank Williams Jr. record. And I remember listening to Hank Jr. singing about whiskey and trucks and stuff. And I remember thinking to myself, like, it's kind of very similar to like this Ghetto Boys record I'm listening to right now, except they're singing about 40s and different types of vehicles and things. I really liked what he. I loved the melody and stuff. It was very similar to me, though. His, Hank Jr. had a very braggadocio, thing happening just like, a rapper would or whatnot. And I remember loving that about him. And I started listening to other things that I thought might be similar to that. So I got into Hank Jr. and David Allan Coe and a lot of them guys early on, like coming out of high school and right about when I should have been going to college, I think. That's when I started getting into country stuff. But as we were making records, I remember me and Kid Rock would sit in the studio. We never left the studio, it feels like, felt like, but we were always mixing. We were always mixing country records with rap records, and if we'd write new songs, we'd always put banjo in them or pedal steel or just always some type of a twang or just different vibe if it sounded good anyway. But I was never opposed to it, and I did like it, but it wasn't until like after I did that Kenny Chesney song with him, everybody's like, "Oh, you need to do a country record," and I was like, "No, I don't. I don't need to do a country record. I like the last thing I need to do right now is try to hop on a bandwagon." So I didn't. I didn't, and then I waited and just kind of, I don't know. I didn't shift things, but I was getting older too, man. Things were different. What I was doing rap wise, I couldn't say the same things I needed to say in a rap song as I could if I was singing it. So I was really like, I don't want to say I was learning how to sing. I was just singing the only way I knew how to sing. Same as now. You know, I just, you kind of just write what's happening at the time. And I guess the country thing just kind of evolved and it just ends up where I'm at. And as far as like the Nashville thing goes, I only moved here about a year and a half ago just for change to get out of Detroit. I'd been there. I thought 49 winters in Detroit was plenty. And so Nashville, I know I don't get away from the winter here, but it's a lot more forgiving.
Exactly. Now, how did you meet Kenny?
I met Kenny one day. Kid Rock called me and says, hey, Kenny Chesney's going to call you. He wants you to do something with him. And I'm like, who? He was like, Kenny Chesney. And I was like, okay, whatever. And but then Kenny called me one day, and he's like, hey, man, it's Kenny Chesney. And he's like, I want you to come down. He was playing Neyland Stadium, Knoxville, Tennessee. The Vols play there, I think. I'm not a sports guy.
That's a big-ass stadium. That's like 128,000 people.
Big joint. This was his first stadium show, and that happened to be his hometown, Neyland, Knoxville. So he was putting together the show and wanted some guest appearances, I bet. And but he had asked me to come out and sing with him, and I was like, sure. And he was like, I'll send the jet. And I was like, send it. Send it. Still waiting on my first royalty, anything. Send that thing. he ended up being I live 2 seconds from him. You know, we'll end up being the greatest, one of the greatest dudes ever as far as the business-wise goes. You know, he's been very helpful to me.
So, you toured with him. You toured with him this summer.
Yep.
So what was that like? Because I saw an article where you said it's different from doing a 30-minute set with him than going, if you do a headlining set on your own, you have to do like an hour and 30. How do you pick and choose what you're going to play? And is it something where after you get into that, it's like in comedy where there's the opener, then the middle act is 30 minutes, and then you're done. And then, but when you have the headline, you go, oh shit, they got to take the checks out. So what is it like for you? Like, is it, do you get comfortable doing that 30 minutes because it's your best hits? It's the stuff off your new album that you think are your favorites. And the people are like, yeah. And then you go and do a longer set and you're like, oh, I got to remember all this crap. I mean, what's it been like for you going back and forth doing that?
Well, it depends on how long in between those long sets there are. I'm terrible at like remembering shit, so I'm always like, what was it? Or I'll pick it up and I'll be like, I'm googling like the first. You just find get the first line, maybe it'll jar or the second line, but it's fabulous to only have to do 30 minutes on a stage, especially since like you were saying, all you got to do is just play the hits and do the next one and beat it. Right? This is it's too easy. But going to the it's a shift. It definitely is a shift, you know, because an hour and a half sucks. An hour and a half of people staring at you, you see the size of me trying to hide behind a microphone stand. That thing's only like this, right? I've never been that comfortable on stage. I don't know. I'm all up in your face, like.
No, it's all right, man. So what's when you play live, what is your personal favorite song to play? I know you have a bunch of songs, but like, you know, I'm sure there's artists that they just sit there and go, this is, and I'm sure, you know, Follow Me, in other words, you've played so many times, you've heard so many times, you're probably like, the crowd's gonna go crazy. But what's like one of your or two personal favorites, and then what is your favorite off your new album?
My favorite song to play live is a song called Good to Be Me. And it's my favorite because it was a song I did, and everybody told me I shouldn't have did it, but I did it anyway. And I just love it. It's my favorite one to do live. And off this first record, my favorite is the title track is Coffee and Beer. Mainly my favorite because I wrote it about my grandpa. And that was my That's pretty much why I love, why it's my favorite, because it makes me think of him anytime I hear it.
So, on your website, people go to Uncle Cracker. It's KRACKER.com. Your closing thing about you says, "When I'm up on stage, I don't feel removed from the people coming to hear the music. You can feel it when they identify with you. Sometimes when I'm up there, I want to tell them I'm not any different than you are." Where does that come from? Did that just come from, how you grew up, that you want to be the everyday man? Because, it's like you don't want to be the rock star, as you said. You don't like how you look on stage sometimes. Is that what it's from? You just want to say, "Hey, man, we got a lot of shit in common, and just enjoy my music."
Absolutely. That's where that comes from. And again, like I said, I'm not rebelling against anything. Like, oh, I don't want to be a rock star. I take as much money as you want to give me, right? I'll take that part. But it's the anonymity that I don't want to that it's the anonymity that's hard to give up. So I think that's partially maybe it's wishful thinking too, but it definitely comes from growing up in a gas station. I am no different than everybody else. And just because I can write a song or two, it doesn't make me any more special than somebody else. So I think that's where all that comes from.
Now, you've had a very successful career, and what in your career, when you look back, what has been the biggest disappointment? Because we can all talk about what we loved. Getting the gold record. I mean, looking on your wall, you have gold records. You have Uncle Cracker. People know you. What has been the biggest disappointment in your career when you look back and you go, "Shit, man, I can't believe that happened," or maybe, "I wish this had happened." I mean, what is something that strikes in your head?
I have a ton of them. I have a ton of disappointments. Mainly like the it's all it's like the things that how do people word this when they say like it's not only the things you say yes to, it's the things you say no to that put you where you're at, right? I've always been a firm believer that if things something was that good, if I didn't need it or want it, I could say no and I wouldn't have to deal with that. I always thought I was fine turning things down. And I did that a lot. I turned down a lot of things. Well, here's one that comes to mind. I regret. This ain't about regrets or nothing, right? It was
Disappointment, or you can also say regret. I mean, you can they run hand in hand a lot.
All right. So the second album comes out, and you remember Luciano Pavarotti used to have this. He used to like own this town, this certain town in Italy, where he grew up and lived, right? He owned this. Well, they had these big pop festivals there every year. Well, they're always hard to try to get the American artists over there because all kinds of reasons, aside from like not paying the statutory rate, not this, aside from all that shit. Well, I remember they asked me to do this festival. It was Luciano Pavarotti's festival, and I'm like, nope, I'm not doing it. I'm not going over there. That was like the first time I was going through a divorce. I was home, and I was like, I'm not leaving home. But the second record came out. I'm going through a little divorce thing then. It was like this whole weird. I said, no, I'm not leaving. I mean, SARS was happening at the time or something. There was some weirdness, right? 9/11, SARS, all kinds of shit. I think I don't know if that, how that if the, I don't know how that unravels in sequence, but there was things happening. Anyway, I turned down the festival. Then he asked me, "Go, no, I'm not going to Italy. I'm not leaving Detroit." Phone call at the house. It's Luciano Pavarotti himself, and I'm like, "How does this even happen?" But sitting there having to tell him, man, I really appreciate the phone call, and I really appreciate the invite and asking me to do it. I really do. I just don't want to leave Detroit. It was really looking back, I wish I would have went to Italy, just because it was Luciano Pavarotti, and it hurt me to tell him no.
So, on the other hand, what is, and I always like to ask this question to artists, What has made you proudest about your career? And I get answers all across the board. You know, why people are proud. Some actors are like, because I could afford to pay my kids through college, through my craft. But for you, looking back, what makes you burst? Because you've had gold records. You played, I mean, just this summer, you're playing in front of Kant stadiums. You know, Tennessee, you're at 138,000. You've toured the world. What makes you most proud about your career?
You know, you nailed it at first when you, as you asked me, and then you went into some options. Literally, one of my most proud moments has been being able to put the kids through college, running around the country being a dumbass, right? That's what I'm most proud of, being able to put my kids through college, having done what I've done. I've done some, I don't want to say I've done unspeakable things, but I've done some pretty dumb things. And my God, we were so young years ago, we did a lot of dumb stuff, but probably most proud of that. Taking care of my, I guess, obligations, my children, and being able to focus and do that stuff. Most proud. None of the other things ever really messed with me. You know, never worried about awards, never worried about, no accolades at all. Money, yeah, I'll take it. I'll take all of it, but
so
that's it. Okay, proud being able to keep my chin up.
See, that's one final question. I even said that was just a final question. What's the future for Uncle Cracker? What's your plan for the next 2 years? Another album? You going to tour? Or you happy with this album now? What do you plan to do in the next, let's say, 2 years?
Next 2 years, yep. Writing an album again right now. Plan on just releasing more music more often, because you can nowadays, I guess. I remember you said we have to wait 3 years in between every album, and I used to beg them to let me do a new one. Just let me do a new one now, but these kids don't know how good they have it these days, right? With the internet and with the being on the line.
It's crazy.
but that's my plan, to be able to release more music more often, and obviously still tour, touring this summer with Jake Owen. That's coming this summer, and then that's it. Really, it's very Groundhog Day-ish for me, to be honest. I feel like I've been doing the same thing every day for the last 25 years.
And you know what? You can't complain about that, though, man. It's a good living.
I don't have any complaints.
I want to thank you for taking the time to come on, Matt. People, go to UncleCracker.com. It's with a K. Go buy his albums. Go buy the new album. Go buy an album. You just go out, you know, just listen and go listen to music, because, you know, and go see him when he's in tour, because live music is one of the best feelings you can go to, especially after the pandemic when the bands came back. Just crowds were so excellent, just into it. Just, you know what, put your fucking phone down. Stop videoing the people, because you get in my way and it's just annoying as shit. And listen to the music. You're never going to watch that video again. So listen to the music. So go to UncleCracker.com. Go to my website, CooperTalk.com. You can find over 1,025 episodes. You can email me at Cooper@CooperTalk.net. I'm not CooperTalk.net, not CooperTalk.com. Go to CooperTalk.net. Email me at Cooper@CooperTalk.net. Also go to YouTube. Search Coop's Comedy Corner. It's my new show. It's a great show. We had some great acts so far. Also, the Coop Tank, my business show. So keep supporting live music, podcasts, comedy. Support it all. I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guests. Don't forget, drink your water, eat your vegetables, take your vitamins, and I'll talk to you next time.